You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org.
Hello, Connor Eccles.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm going to introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter. Connor Eccles, managing editor of the Non-Zero Newsletter. And you decided not to stay in your socialist paradise? I'm surprised. I thought you'd be filing from Cuba for the rest of your life, but
yeah, I thought I was going to stick around. I mean, there might have been some uphill battles there. It's a bit of a challenging environment on the journalism side of things. But I guess if I would have gone towed the government line a little bit, maybe I could have stuck around.
I assumed you would. I mean, you're an actual you're an actual lefty,
living, breathing socialist. Yeah, I wouldn't say that Cuba is my ideal version of socialism, but maybe we can talk about that later. Okay. It's certainly got its challenges, to say the least.
Meanwhile, there's a whole nother issue of The Earthling, the Friday edition of Non-Zero Newsletter, that will hit newsstands all over America not long after we tape.
That's right. That's right.
And
yeah, you have a very strong lead this week. You're back. You had initially given a few weeks, allowing me to be sort of the editor, guest editor, I think is the term we use. But your influence has come roaring back with a piece on this Manus AI stuff.
Well, we're still kind of in the twilight zone, I guess, which I wouldn't mind staying in, where I have I have more like my prior degree of involvement, but not quite as oppressive as it used to be. And in the making the newsletter, I mean, yeah. So, and then there are also these, we've got items also before I start talking about the AI thing on Syria. Good news, bad news for Syria, I guess, in terms of the unity of Syria. Right. And then the famous case of the student at Columbia who was rounded up for reasons that have yet to be clearly articulated, but obviously had to do with his role in pro-Palestinian demonstrations. And then I want to talk about Ukraine and the status of the ceasefire effort there. And give Donald Trump some guidance, which he's always been receptive to in the past. So I think this should get us over the finish line as far as the ceasefire goes. I have some ideas. But yeah, on the AI, I don't know how widely this basic story is known, but certainly in AI circles, there was all of this news about Manus, M-A-N-U-S, a new AI agent that came out of China. And initially the idea was, oh my God, another DeepSeek moment. DeepSeek being the AI model from China that got so much attention a couple of months ago. And I think rightly so, for the most part. That was a surprising and significant achievement, which suggested, among other things, that our chip restrictions are unlikely to keep China at much distance from the frontiers of AI research, and had some other morals as well. But anyway, this Manus thing was, and the initial online, there were, including these serious, sober people, Tyler Cowen and other people saying, whoa, this looks big. And then that kind of subsided. And then as the week closed, we came up with a wholly original Non-Zero Newsletter take, which I articulate and will share. But first of all, what Manus is, it's an agent. So it goes online and does stuff for you. They called it, this Chinese company nobody had ever heard of, called it an autonomous agent, maybe overstating it. But it's true that it was a kind of unprecedented combination of two kinds of functionality that are already available from American companies. So one is deep research. And by the way, Google just came out with a new and better version of that, but OpenAI's got one, Perplexity's got one. This is a new thing just within the last couple of months that is an agent in the sense that it goes online and researches and synthesizes the results and comes back and gives you a report. And then there's OpenAI's operator or Anthropic's computer use, both of which, although I think only OpenAI's is really very much kind of released, I'm not sure, but which goes online and like orders pizza for you and stuff. And like is a little more in that sense active and less in the way of just reading stuff and synthesizing. Although both of them have to like click around on the web. Right. And that poses new hazards, which I'll get to because I think they're significant for this story. So anyway, Manus, they came out with this impressive demo video. And then a number of kind of influencers, well, what were they? That's a thing. Okay. So in AI watching, the ecosystem of AI watchers, there's everything from true journalists to kind of hack influencers. And the line between the two is blurry because there's like a whole bunch of podcasters. And some of these podcasters, like, you know, the corporate execs know they can go on these podcasts, talk about a new model, and they won't face a lot of critical questioning. I won't mention podcast names. There's some podcasts I listen to because they're informative, but I don't consider, in that sense, I don't consider them quite real journalism. Anyway, it turned out that really, this company had very tightly controlled who has access to this. I still don't think it's publicly available. And so
no, it's a wait list. I'm still on the wait list. I would very much like to get off the wait list. It's it's apparently long.
I'm not even on the wait list, but I think I get the basic idea in terms of what it could do. So an example was it goes online and researches stocks and puts the results into a website that has these various interactive graphics. So like all of that from like one set of instructions, you press a button, it does all of that. Now, the components of that can all be done by American agents, you know, or American AI features. Claude in particular does a great job of the coding that produces the graphs. And there are also these standalone products that sit on top of American LLMs, and you just tell it what you want, and it creates this website and this graph. And increasingly, it's like you don't need a whole lot of further guidance. So the components is available, but this company put them together in a new way. It was a more powerful package. So let me stop there and before I proceed to my view of the moral of the story. And ask you what whether you need blanks filled in or anything.
No, I think it makes a lot of. I mean, I it's been very impressive. I guess it's worth highlighting the extent to which the demos are impressive. And I guess you don't know if they've messed with these, but like one that you can get on their website. And again, it shows you the prompt. It shows you sort of a screen recording of the thing going through. One was it. They asked it to make sort of a role-playing game, like an old-school role-playing game with text of you going through the White House meeting between like Zelensky, Trump, and Vance. And it was good. It was very good. It was kind of clever. It showed you who you were pissing off. It was like you're playing Zelensky and you're trying to like work your way through this and maintain weapon sales and stuff to your country. And it's kind of fun. And I was impressed with just the amount of sort of creativity, I guess. That's a bit of a loaded word in AI, but the creativity that it showed. It's an impressive thing if only being like a wrapper for these other technologies that are already existing.
Yeah. Wrapper is a somewhat pejorative term for products that just sit on top of these LLMs. And it wasn't clear at first that that's what this was. Okay, so first of all, I mean, clearly sat on top of some LLM, but for all anybody knew, they had built this whole new LLM. And then somebody did a little investigative work and found that, to a large extent, it's sitting on this American LLM, Anthropic's Claude. And then the company, I think, after that was revealed, came out and said, well, it's also draws on this Chinese model known as Quinn, which I think is created by Alibaba, but is a big LLM. So this is what's called a wrapper. And it's funny, the conventional wisdom on this has shifted. Some people use wrapper pejoratively, and they've said, like, you know, look, there's, like, for example, if you see a company that's marketing like sales chatbots or customer support chatbots, including some big companies, but they are powered by existing well-known LLMs, and those are known as wrappers. They mess around with the system prompt, maybe do some reinforcement learning or something you can do through whatever you can do through an API, and come up with these products. I think it was discussed on some podcast aspect of the Manus thing, before I get to my own take on this, is that it's another reason to start wondering whether we should invert the logic. In other words, it isn't that these wrappers, the conventional wisdom in these wrappers are not going to live long, because ultimately these increasingly powerful LLMs will just do everything. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you will go and you'll subscribe to Claude or GPT, and the wrapper companies will go away because they will just do everything any wrapper could do. They'll be able to give you a sales bot, a chat bot, legal advice, medical advice, whatever. So now more people are saying, you know, I think the LLMs may get commoditized, because there's now an increasingly number of pretty damn good ones. Nobody, right. You know, ChatGPT's got brand recognition, but it's increasingly unclear that they will enduringly have a clearly better LLM than anybody else. And if that's the case, you know, their profit margins may shrink. And it may be that the money gets made by these wrapper companies that can just pick any of a number of LLMs. You know, they don't have to pay any of these companies a lot of money, because the LLM companies won't have bargaining power. And this, some people took Manus to be a good example of this. It's like, you know, like I said, they use these two LLMs. They could have used two other LLMs, but what blew everyone away was the combined functionality of the quote wrapper, right? The total functionality. So anyway, as I want to mention this, you said if the demos are legit, I think the demos were legit, but again, it was not released widely. So people, skeptics were not allowed to kind of, put it through its paces and see what went wrong. I mean, slowly it got out to some skeptics, but initially, it was very well controlled. My favorite, it went out very early to this guy named Rowan Cheung, Cheung. He has a big following, and he has a podcast, but certainly newsletter. And he's one of these guys who can be counted on for a softball interview. So Sundar Pichai talks, so everybody talks to him. And I just thought it was funny that he says somewhere, I want to emphasize, here it is. You know, so he puts out this video saying, this is amazing. And I think it's all stuff it was truly doing. He had it do research. He had it research him, including go through a social media feed, and then build a website about him, you know, that like his fans might go through, click through and stuff. And it was good. Great. But anyway, I thought it was funny. He said, this post was not sponsored in any way. The co-founder of Manus did give us the rundown, which is his podcasting and newsletter, 500 invite codes. And then he says, I just added these to the Rundown University's perks. So, I mean, obviously that's a monetary value to him. I'm sorry. You know,
it's not sponsored. In other words, no, it's totally not sponsored. They're just giving us all these perks.
Yeah. They gave him a paywall bonus he could give. And you know, this is when people are begging for access to Manus. So anyway, I'm sorry, but
no, that's funny. That sounds so much like the whole, like, you know, in theory, Trump is not doing any conflicts of interest with the Elon Musk stuff, and then he's like, well, but I will buy the car and advertise it online. But it's like, there's no payment. We don't need to get into that, but it's just so,
yeah,
it's the ideas about like conflicts really feel like they're going away a little bit. It feels like some of those norms are eroding.
Yes. And you will have a piece on that in the Non-Zero newsletter before too long, I believe, on
that's right,
that whole conglomerate of corruption. So anyway, I would say the, you know, in the piece, I kind of lay out what the online argument has been about. I think the point that I didn't see made anywhere, as it tends not to be, is that I think Manus really drives home the fact that we are going to have some degree of international regulation of AI, because, you know, one thing that was discovered is that, first of all, I mean, as the week wore on, people realized, you know, the thing is pretty janky. A, it's not that reliable. And B, it doesn't seem to have any guardrails of the kind that American companies would put on. And in fact, if you ask, you know, well, why didn't an American company do this? I think, you know, that is an answer you heard for online that makes sense, is that they're very risk averse. They could be, if something goes wrong, they could be subject to litigation. They also have reputations to defend. They're just not going to put a product like this that's this half-baked and potentially dangerous out there. And the reason it's dangerous, one reason, is because these AI agents, once they go out online, they are vulnerable to something called prompt injection, which is, you know, you can basically, you would set up a website that's kind of inviting an agent to click on it. And then the website finds a way to alter the system prompt of the, so it can kind of hijack the agent. And I asked Claude, which should know, like, what kinds of dangers can ensue when you have agents roaming the web and they're vulnerable to prompt injection? And it just listed like 10 scary things. My favorite, or kind of the most terrifying, was the fact that the prompt injection could make the AI agent go around infecting other AI agents to get all of them to do whatever malicious work somebody wanted done. So as Claude wrote, vulnerable agents could be instructed to spread malicious prompts to other agents, creating cascading effects throughout AI systems. And so you can just, there's just almost a limit to the nightmare scenarios you can imagine in principle. Now, we're not there yet because there's not that many agents out there. They're not that powerful and so on. But we will reach a point where this will be a genuine concern. And the point I'm making is just that, like, and it was inspired partly by Tyler Cowen's post, noting that there's probably no way to keep an AI agent made in China out of the U.S., you know, out of the U.S. computer ecosystem. People can use VPNs and so on. And, you know, even aside from that, suppose you somehow keep anyone from the U.S. from using the model, it's still the case that if we see some kind of cascading effect like this, right, it's parts of the American information infrastructure that could get wiped out. So
yeah,
my the point is just that you're going to need some degree of cooperation, including China, to come up with rules of the road, at least norms. You would at least like more transparency. And I would say ultimately you're going to need actual written agreements, also known as treaties. And that's, it's not like a radical insight, I guess. But my point is just that it's so characteristic of the whole conversation that, so far as I can tell, nobody else is saying it. It's like, I really pay close attention to this. Like, I have my Twitter list of AI people, and I'm trying to follow the whole conversation. And it is just so, it's so divided between, on the one hand, all these libertarians, like, you know, Tyler Cowen, libertarian, he notes the fact that we can't keep this thing out of our ecosystem, but he certainly doesn't go on to talk about global governance. You know, libertarians tend not to think that way. There's a lot of those in Silicon Valley. And then at the other extreme, there's the hardcore doomers who are just kind of like, stop, you know? And there's not even all that many of them. It's more of a libertarian flavored conversation, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, the big challenge with this, like, it's good. Like, obviously it's good to do rules of the road. It's good to do these, but it feels like a proper treaty. This is just one of those examples where you have a hard time. And I guess with any treaty, you have a hard time picturing how you get there without some really acute crisis, right? Like something has to go really wrong. And it's kind of hard to picture, you know, with something that needs to like shock us out of our thing, either, or just to get to the precipice of a thing, right? Like the Cuban Missile Crisis was very important for future arms control treaties, even though nothing like happened per se. You know, it just almost happened and would have been quite bad. So it's kind of hard to tell what exactly it might look like for something to wake people up on this.
Yeah. You hope that it'll be something clearly illustrative and not that devastating, right? Like,
right.
It just demonstrates the kind of thing that can happen, but it doesn't happen on a hugely destructive scale that kills a lot of people or something. I mean, you know, I guess, you know, like if somehow a whole power grid gets taken out in China and the US at the same time, I'm not recommending this, but, you know, but kind of nobody dies, but you get the idea, you know, that's what you'd want. So yeah,
it's a hard one.
Now and then Anthropic this week noted that its latest version of Claude, quote, demonstrates concerning improvements in its capacity to sort aspects of biological weapons development. It said this in a report to the government. Does it go on to propose, even though clearly bioweapons are a transnational threat, right? Does it go on to propose international cooperation? Quite the opposite. Anthropic wants more confrontation with China. They want tighter chip restrictions, which incidentally are good for companies like Anthropic at a surely economic level. Although I don't really think the head of Anthropic is motivated so much by that. I think he's an ideologue. Anyway, So that's the AI report.
Yeah, well, that is interesting. Yeah, the Manus thing, it is. I hope I get off the whatever. You just put your name on the wait list. I hope I get off that at some point because it is quite interesting, if a little scary.
Yeah, I don't think you have to worry about it like hurting your, well, it's not impossible. In fact, that it could hurt your computer. I mean, in fact, right. Like I just did an OpenAI deep research thing. And when you think about it, that's going around and clicking on websites. I have never before let anybody but me on my computer and maybe my wife or daughter go around clicking on websites, right? Obviously, they're websites you don't want to click on. And
right.
I noticed that after I did this, my browser crashed and I'm like, whoa, did deep research get duped? You know, you are heading into kind of uncharted terrain.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. We should look into that a little bit. That's an interesting topic. Do we want to talk about this? You've already talked about a little bit of this on podcast this week, but the Columbia student who is still now being detained by DHS. ICE.
I mean, you looked in. I think you know more than I do about this. It's a very well publicized story. I do want to talk about this NPR thing that kind of embarrassed a Trump administration official about it. But first, I think you know more than I do about the actual legal grounding of this.
Yeah, why don't I run through the legal stuff? Let me pull up some of the language too. But the basic thing is that you know, the big question here, right, is basically, does Trump have the right to deport a green card holder over speech that Trump doesn't like, right? So if you look, there's some evidence that the administration didn't realize that he was a green card holder when they went to arrest him, that they thought he was still on a student visa. He had spoken in the past about being on a student visa, so it sounds like that might have been just like a confusion from like press reports versus different things. But he had become a green card holder since last year, And as far as I can tell. And basically, the Trump administration has made no claim that he has violated the law, right? So there's nothing about material support for terrorism. There's none of those things. They're not going down that road at this point. The only claim that they've made, and the claim that they appear to be, you know, pursuing in court or plan to pursue in court, is that his presence in the U.S. could cause, quote, potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences for the United States, end quote. And that comes from the Immigration and Nationality Act. It's this very little used part of it that basically gives the Secretary of State the power to just about deport anyone, right? If they can make the argument that it is within their foreign policy, right? So a couple things on like the process of all of this, and then I'll talk about the way in which that might hold up in court or not. But so like the process question, it's important to note a couple of things. His name is Mahmoud Khalil. He won't appear before a regular judge. Immigration judges are different. He will not have like full due process rights, things like that. He does not have a right to a public defender, though he does have his defense attorney, does not have a right to a jury trial. This will simply be a removal hearing with a single judge, and that judge will be someone from the Justice Department, will not be an independent judge. So this will be a judge who is subject to Pam Bondi, the attorney general.
Well, then it's kind of hopeless for him, it sounds like.
It's hopeless at the start, it seems. And then who knows? Who knows what this judge will say?
But
I imagine
Didn't some judge grant an injunction or something that halted the whole thing? And I was under the impression that it would then get reviewed on kind of constitutional grounds. But
so there, no. I mean, there are different questions surrounding all this. I think that the removal hearing has to take place first before you can appeal, because he hasn't been formally, because the problem with the Trump administration's initial move was they thought that they could unilaterally revoke his green card. That's wrong. They can't do that. That has to go through these removal hearings, which go through immigration judges, which are, again, Justice Department employees and not regular federal judges. But then the next step is, let's say that judge determines that he is eligible for deportation, does revoke his green card. Then step two, they appeal, obviously. And there's two kind of core things that'll be at play here. So the first, and this is kind of an interesting coincidence of this, is that this specific clause has actually been deemed unconstitutional due to its vagueness by a judge in the federal courts at the district court level, right? So this is not a Supreme Court question, but the judge that did that, kind of ironically, is Trump's sister, Marianne Trump Barry, who made that determination in 1996. So it's kind of just a funny coincidence.
Is not a fan of his, as I recall.
No, I don't think she was. But so what was interesting about that situation, though, is that basically she made the argument that the case, that this was so vague that you couldn't be able to predict in advance, in a fair way, whether or not you had violated the law, right? Whether or not the action that you would pursue would violate the law. So essentially, since foreign policy is so constantly changing and so secretive, it is meaningfully impossible for you to know for sure if you are complying with this law, and it's thus too vague, right? So that's a due process mm-hmm. question, separate from free mm-hmm. speech. The free mm-hmm. speech side of things comes down to, there had been a court case, a Supreme Court case in the 90s, I believe this one was also in the 90s, that determined that all resident aliens in the U.S., like using the formal term, have access to the full suite of First Amendment protections that anyone else does. That doesn't, you know, people can still be removed from the country on criminal grounds and different things, but that argument has been made. And that is what the Supreme Court has held, but not in regards to the specific statute. The specific part of the specific statute has not been addressed by the top level court. So really the question is whether the Supreme Court in this situation, assuming that this does, he is, you know, there is a determination that he should be deported, and then that gets appealed up to the Supreme Court. The question for them will be whether they hold to the precedent on free speech grounds, which seems to be the single strongest, especially due, because the allegations from the Trump administration only include free speech related infractions, or like speech related infractions. So either they hold that, or they kind of buckle under the Trump administration and choose to remove him. But I mean, that gets back to the fundamental thing that, you know, the Constitution is whatever, you know, nine guys in robes says it is. So that's kind of where we're stuck now.
Well, I'm hopeful that in general, Trump is being scary enough that you'll be able to get five votes in the Supreme Court to, you know, counteract his initiatives in a number of realms. But we'll see. Some reason to believe that you will, but we'll see. Yeah, I couldn't believe it on NPR. So I turned it on, and it was Morning Edition, and the host, Michelle Martin, was interviewing some guy from the Trump administration who is Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security, pretty high-ranking position. And I just thought he made a total fool of himself. I mean, I was surprised on two grounds. First of all, NPR, it's not the BBC. You don't often see a lot of acute pushback during interviews, right? And she did a fairly good job. I mean, there's a couple of opportunities I was kind of hoping she'd seize that she didn't, but she persisted on this one question. It's like, if he is going to be deported for doing something, don't you have to be able to point to some specific behavior? Like the guy was, you know, being incredibly vague, like terrorism, this, that. And she's like, okay, what did he do? How did he support terrorism? How did he do this? And he was so unprepared. I mean, I thought, did he think this was Fox News or what? What did he think he was walking into? They're going to ask you this question on NPR. And I think you listened to it. Maybe I'm overstating it. I thought you could tell at the end he was pretty deflated, but maybe I'm wrong. What, did you listen to it, right? You
saw it online? It's pretty stark. Yeah, I mean, it's 5 minutes. So, you know, the guy's name is Troy Edgar. If anyone wants to, you know, I recommend going and listening to that exchange because it is really striking. I mean, he basically just keeps telling her, like, well, it's obvious, right? It's obvious why he's being deported. Yeah. Go online and look. Have you not seen it? He won't say anything.
Yeah, he says, it was all on TV. It was all on TV. And she says, well, I'm kind of surprised you can't tell us what it was you saw on TV that he did. And the guy says, well, I'm surprised you can't tell us what you saw on TV that he did. It's like, I was kind of hoping she'd say, wait a second, I'm not the one making the allegation, but I guess that was obvious to everybody how absurd it was for him to blame her. I was frankly surprised by how stupid he seemed. He didn't even do a good job of evasion. You know,
no.
It was just like because I had now he was in the Trump administration first time around. But, you know, I'd heard about all these think tanks grooming the new Trump 2.0 team. I assumed you'd have a little bit of intellectual firepower in there. I'm sure you do somewhere. But I guess this guy was not among the groomed. I don't know.
No, it doesn't seem that way. Yeah, I mean, it is a really stark thing to listen to. Again, it's just. This whole situation, I think, has been marked, and maybe this is a smart approach from the Trump administration if their main goal is to chill free speech, right, is that the vagueness of all of this, I think, has been a real tool to their advantage, right? Like, they're just kind of insisting upon all of these things. And in that process, I mean, you're seeing the response from administrators at universities. I've already seen like some things from those where they're saying, you know, if you're on a student visa, if you're on a green card, keep quiet, right?
Right.
That is the general feeling in America right now among students who might have points of view that are at odds with the Trump administration. And I think that the vagueness with which they're pursuing this is almost the point.
Yeah. And I didn't really realize, I'm not that clear in immigration law, but apparently green card status is it's a pretty significant standing to have legally.
Yeah.
It's, you are a permanent resident, even though you're not quite citizen. Sure. And a lot is supposed to go with that.
But as opposed to student visas, which the State Department can just revoke those so to be clear, they do have the ability. You know, I mean, there's a question of if it's explicitly on free speech grounds, I could see a challenge being brought, but in theory they have the ability to revoke your student visa for I think really any reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, I fear that we may see that exercised on a large scale then.
Yeah, we almost certainly will.
So what remains? There's Russia and there's Russia, Ukraine, there's Syria.
There's Syria, yeah.
And there's
maybe a little Cuba too.
Oh, and Cuba. So let's talk a little Russia, and maybe before we go into overtime, at least, and then maybe we can talk more there if there's more to say. Have you been? Well, I guess everybody's been following this.
Hard not to follow. Yeah. So, well, maybe I'll just lay out a little bit of the news to make sure that everyone is caught up. So, we had more negotiations in Saudi Arabia this week. One sort of narrative that's been interesting is that so you've got Rubio, Secretary of State Rubio, you've got National Security Advisor Waltz, and then you have I'm blanking on his name right now. It's not the, so they've sidelined this like Kellogg guy, Keith Kellogg, who is supposed to be sort of the Ukraine negotiator, has no longer had as big of a role, but Steve Witkoff has kind of come in more.
By the way, just parenthetically, they apparently also fired this guy who made the mistake of saying that, I think what he literally said was that the people in Hamas don't have horns growing out of their head or something. Did you know that?
Yeah, well, he's the one. Well, I want to double check that because I thought I saw that he might have been like that. He may or may not have actually been fired. I need to nail that down. But apparently there's been some reprimanding. It's Adam Bowler, I think his name is. And
he was negotiating over the hostages and stuff. He was important.
Yeah, and he's the first American, as far as we know, to have negotiated directly with Hamas in some time, if ever. Right. So that's a pretty notable. That's a pretty notable step because even Israel doesn't negotiate. I mean, they have mediators. I'm sure that like Mossad people are meeting with Hamas people, but you know, in theory, they don't negotiate with Hamas.
Right.
But yeah, so we had these talks in Saudi Arabia. The result of that was that Zelensky agreed in principle to a 30-day ceasefire. There seemed to be sort of a calming of the tensions between the U.S. and Ukraine on that. The response from Russia has been at best sort of lukewarm to cold on that. They are kind of seem very kind of determined to press their advantage. I think you had a little bit more of a detailed knowledge of what they're looking for now.
I mean, this wasn't the formal response, but Putin said kind of like, well, obviously we're gonna have to get some guarantees about these 30 days. He's just talking about the ceasefire, not the final deal. And he's saying, you know, like, obviously you can't let weapons keep coming into Ukraine. You can't let Ukraine continue its, quote, forced mobilization, by which he means conscription. Now, we've all seen the videos where, it looks pretty forced. You know, there's some guy trying to evade the draft and several people grab him, throw him into a van, unless like his grandmother succeeds in fending them off, which does happen sometimes. It's an interesting approach to law enforcement. But he's saying they would have to stop military conscription. And they would have to stop, you know, I mean, this is, it seems to me, he's saying no, the in effect. I mean, Ukraine, I mean, one interesting, ironic consequence of the famous White House fracas between Zelensky and J.D. Vance and Trump is that it, in a certain sense, has strengthened Zelensky's bargaining position because now he got more explicit support from Europe, specific commitments, I think, including some short-term commitments of resources and money. So if you assume that the frack is not going to lead to less support than he would have otherwise gotten from Trump, because the suspension of aid is now over, he can better, Ukraine is in a stronger position to say no in principle, because they have a better chance of surviving. Although God knows they're not in the driver's seat in this war. So I don't see them accepting this. And what bothers me is Trump is saying, well, if Russia doesn't agree to this, I'm going to impose sanctions. I mean, come on, another sanction? I just can't believe that's going to get their attention.
Yeah.
First of all, they probably won't be that heavy, but in any event, like, they're just desensitized to sanctions. I mean, if Trump, there is a way Trump can probably lead us to a deal if he wants to do what he said he would do. A couple of years ago, he said, and I complimented him at the time, he said, here's what I'm going to do if I'm president. I'm going to lay down a deal, and I'm going to say to Ukraine, if you don't accept it, your weapons are cut off. And I'm going to say to Putin, if you don't accept it, I'm going to flood Ukraine with weapons. Okay. Now that is exactly the way to approach this. I said at the time, he's got the game theory right. And he has the power. He could easily, I mean, even some small scale thing, like if he got Congress to authorize, I don't know, half a billion, a billion in weapons and give him the discretion to release them, you know, at any amount of that at any point over the next 3 months or something, like even though that itself may not be enough to completely intimidate Putin, that is a real attention getter, especially if he can convert it into materiel that is actually needed right now. Like, and I don't know how much that there is, artillery, shells, drones, but that's the way to proceed. And I have never been one to say, what is Trump's special deal with Putin? Are they paying him under the table? Blah, blah, blah. On Russiagate, I was like an agnostic. I said, don't jump to conclusions. In the end, there was no smoking gun. But I got to say, if Trump doesn't do that, and it looks like he's not going to, because he thinks he's being very manly by threatening sanctions, apparently. You have to ask. And I don't think the answer is necessarily some secret payoff deal, but there is something weird going on psychologically. Like he doesn't play hardball with Putin, I will have to conclude that I don't think he's really, well, whatever. There's something, I think he's, you know, maybe it's just as simple as like Putin at one point said to him, sure, we'd be happy to help you build hotels in Moscow. And maybe it's something like Trump just thinks, you know, unlike most of the leaders I deal with in Europe, this guy's probably going to be in power for a long time and he's corrupt as shit. You know, I just want to stay at his good graces. It could be that. But I'm sorry, the time has come to, you know, and I really would like to hear a little more pushback from some sectors of the restrainer community that seem more reluctant to criticize Trump harshly than I would have hoped.
Yeah, I mean, two things there. The first is that I guess the less sinister interpretation that I would give is of this sort of influence or of this sort of psychological situation is that I just really do think that Trump has a different frame of reference for like leaders of great powers than he does for leaders of other countries. I don't think that he particularly respects the position of president of France. Yeah. I don't think that he particularly respects the president of Mexico or Canada or prime minister of Canada, rather, or any of those things. But I do think he sincerely respects Russia and China as powers, even if he really disagrees with them. And I think you see that in how he treats them, right? Like the rhetoric that he's willing to wield against other states and the tools that he's willing to wield against other states just are different, right? So I think like the generous version there is that he really sort of he gets that he's in this club and that the actions within that club are a little bit different.
Yeah.
On the restraint thing, or do you want to respond to that? And then I'll.
Well, I just say the variables are conflated because as it happens, the closest thing to great powers, I mean, China really genuinely powerful, Russia pretty damn powerful. They certainly have both have their share of nukes and stuff. They are also both authoritarian. So they're both strong.
Right.
So the argument that he's sweet for strong men and the argument that he's sweet for great powers is, you know, it's hard to separate the evidence. And I will say, look, if it's the great powers, you could argue that he has America's interests at heart. Obviously, great powers can deliver more to America than minor powers. So there is that argument, but I don't trust him. I'm sorry. I just don't trust him to not first think about what these great powers could do for him personally, A,
yeah,
and B,
sure.
I think it's in America's interest to end this damn war in Ukraine right now, and he has the power to do it, and it looks like he's not going to exercise it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. On the restraint side of things, I think that this is a really challenging test because we're actually seeing for the first time people who are genuinely very sympathetic to the military restraint movement getting big and serious jobs, right? We have you know, Tulsi Gabbard, her relationship to restraint is obviously a little bit complicated and controversial, but she is the director of national intelligence. She did just try to hire Danny Davis, who's very much in the restraint camp. Apparently that's been spiked, but was the thing seriously being considered? You've got, you know, some people at the like just under congressional, you know, congressional approval level that are going in. You've got a number of these different positions where people with some actual restraint bona fides are getting jobs. And, you know, it's the question of how do you deal with a movement like restraint if you are the Republican Party, if you're Donald Trump, is that you try to co-opt it, right? But it also means that people that are within the restraint movement, so long as they're willing to play ball a little bit and be a little bit less critical, like you saw from a lot of liberal internationalists under Biden, then maybe they're going to be listened to a little bit more. At least that's the theory, right? So it is captured.
Yep.
To a certain extent. People are being a little bit captured.
Yeah, I want to talk about this a little more. Maybe we should we go ahead and do overtime, move into overtime?
Yeah, let's do it. So overtime
and topics. Connor, tell me, how can people get access to the overtime part of our conversation?
Oh, well, they can actually navigate to our nicely shortened URL now, nonzero.org. That is the Substack for, of course, the Nonzero newsletter published by you, Robert Wright. And you'll get both this overtime segment, all the overtime segments for all these conversations. And in addition to that, all of our content from the newsletter that is behind the paywall. It is an astonishing amount of great stuff, really, one must say. So, yeah, highly recommend it.
Okay, so thanks to everybody who stayed with us this far. Hope you follow us into overtime. If not, see you next time.
This was a free preview of Nonzero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.